Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. That theme song comes to us courtesy of senior producer Jenny Amott. We've been giving each of our team an opportunity to pick a theme song. We're still not sure what we're going to end up as a theme song to this show, but we'll see how things develop in the days ahead. Thank you all for being here at 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you, as we always do, live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Greg Bluestein, AJC political reporter, is with us. Jackie Gingrich Cushman, a Republican blogger and columnist. Conservative, I think, is a better way to say that than to give you a party label, Jackie. Thank you for being here today. And former U.S. Congressman, Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden from up there in Cobb County. Buddy, thank you for coming back to visit with us.
I'm glad to be here, and I am a Democrat.
Yes. We have a few news headlines, and then we're going to get into our first topic, which will be looking at what's going on with education at the Capitol right now. A story that really is just developing in the last few minutes. CNN has reported that the House Intelligence Chairman, Devin Nunes, at a news conference a short time ago, said that in looking through intelligence reports, he's found that there may have been potential inadvertent surveillance of Donald Trump himself. He called it normal incidental collection. In other words, he's suggesting that intelligence agents may have been listening in specifically to people who ended up talking to Donald Trump. On one hand, Nunes is quoted as saying that it appears to be normal. It doesn't appear to have anything to do with Russia. But then he goes on to say he's alarmed by it. So we're going to have to watch how that sorts itself out. This story is really just developing. A couple of other quick headlines. The legislature passed, Greg Bluestein, a $25 billion 2018 fiscal budget today. It goes to Governor Deal. It includes raises for teachers, state employees. This is one of the earliest ever times.
Yeah, we were talking last night. I think it is the earliest in the last decade or so, at least. And it does bring rise to the hope, maybe, that the session could actually end before next Thursday.
Yeah, they have 4 days left, including 4 days, period. Right. And they don't have to do anything. The budget's the only thing
it's
they
done.
Really are required by statute to do.
And it's really a rather non-contentious budget process.
Yeah.
All sides, the governor, the Senate, and the House, you know, they quibbled over smaller matters, but nothing big in the budget that they quibbled over.
Another quick headline. Today happens to be National Agriculture Day. And it comes as Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Agriculture, Georgia's own Sonny Perdue, is preparing for confirmation hearings next week. As Greg Bluestein reported, Democrats are looking to cause him a little trouble on the Hill and in advance of the hearings, conjuring up a reminder that back when Roy Barnes, Governor Roy Barnes, worked to remove the Confederate battle emblem from the Georgia state flag during his campaign for governor, Sonny Perdue said he was going to take care of that and reverse what Governor Barnes had done. So it's going to be interesting to see how that developed. No reason to think that's going to stop his nomination.
No, I'd say Perdue's supporters think he has at least 60 votes. He has several Democrats who are already on his camp and who are introducing him, including House Member David Scott.
Okay, so that hearing begins next week, and we'll obviously be paying attention to it. You want to get a quick word in, Buddy?
Yes, very quickly. They'll have a lot of fun with him and bruise him up a little bit. He'll get confirmed easily. But what I wanted to say is that this will be a great time for the legislature to go home.
We think so, too.
Always a good time,
right? We're going to talk education because a couple of the more important bills that are hanging in the balance down there at the Capitol are education measures. And to do that, we've invited AJC education writer Maureen Downey, who you read in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, but also has a great whose work appears on the Get Schooled blog at AJC.com. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a look at the few measures that really we're still waiting to see unfold. One of them is what is being called, I think primarily by opponents, the Opportunity School District's LIGHT. This measure caused an enormous amount of controversy. It does give the state the opportunity that it didn't get in the referendum late last year to take over underperforming schools automatically, but it still moves in that direction. Is that a fair way of stating it in its most general terms, Maureen?
It's a fair way of stating it. It's a much gentler version of the OSD in that it doesn't strong arm the state's role in helping underperforming low-income school districts. It's a much more sort of gracious bill where the person, the chief turnaround officer, the CTO that the bill creates, a new position, a new high-level position, somewhat has to be invited in to help the schools, although there is some coercion in the bill, but not nearly as much as there was in the OSD.
One of the most contentious aspects of this bill, and I think I'm right to say that it continues to be, Maureen, is that the bill creates the position of turnaround officer, and that officer reports not to the DOE, to the Department of Education, but rather to the state school board, which, of course, is appointed by the governor, right?
Yes, and I concur with I agree with Richard Woods, our state school superintendent, that it would have made more sense to have the CTO report to him in DOE. And it's really because the position, the CTO, doesn't come with a lot of money. And to do what the CTO is supposed to do, and that is turn around struggling schools, almost all of which in Georgia are poor schools, that person's going to need to tap DOE resources because that person's going to have, from what I can see, very little of her or his own. So I think it's important that there's a great working relationship between the CTO, the single individual, and the Department of Education, where expertise does exist. And I think setting them up as equals or as the gulf between them, I think that's a mistake. I think it's going to add unnecessary time to sort of getting this thing up and running.
Is this just a plain and simple Buddy Jackie Greg power struggle between the governor and Richard Wood, or is there some thinking by the authors of this measure that this is a helpful matter?
Well, according to the letters between the two parties, well, it is right. Very much a power struggle. And the governor wanted, and remember, this will affect the final stretch of his two terms in office. But this is really for the next governor, the governor for that. And I think Governor Deal wanted to make sure that that power was vested in the governor's office and not in the superintendent's office, and made it very clear in the series of letters back and forth.
No, I think you're right. I mean, Governor Deal has been very clear since he took office that he's been very behind education. This has obviously been a priority of his, not only for schools that are failing, but also for children that are in quality care before they get into school. And I think he does want to make sure it's successful. I think he wants to make sure it's spotlighted and that there is someone that's separate from the Board of Education, but also someone that thinks about it all the time. And that's what this chief turnaround officer is going to do. And while it does take resources, if you look at, what really makes a great school, makes a big difference to children that are disadvantaged, it's really having someone that's interested in, someone that spends time with them, someone that challenges them, someone that actually believes in them and thinks that they can do something. So there are a lot of things that can be done at the community level, on the local level, with the CTO's help that I think will make a big difference.
Maureen, is that the way you see this? Is there a valid reason? I know you've already said you think it's the wrong decision, but does the governor make any valid arguments about why this should be outside of DOE?
I don't think there are valid arguments for it to be outside DOE. I think that we have a history in Georgia of governors who simply don't like the sitting superintendent, and they've developed sort of workarounds, and that's what the governor's office of student achievement is as well. Governors aren't satisfied with the elected superintendent. I don't think there's ever been any warmth between Governor Deal and Richard Woods, so I think that's a problem from the start. I also want to address Jackie's comment about someone who cares about children. I don't think we're going to see that. We're not going to see the CTO having time to go in and sit down with kids at school lunch or get to know the teachers. This person is going to be a facilitator of turnaround coaches who may or may not be nationally hired, may be locally hired. It's not clear where they're going to come from. And they're the ones who are supposed to be on the ground in the schools. I would argue that on the ground in those schools right now are principals, assistant principals, and teachers who already know those kids. So why don't we see what we can do, what they can do, since they already have half the battle won, in that they know who the kids are and what they need. This CTO will definitely be executive level. I don't expect this woman or man to be out there pushing kids on swings, talking to kids in pep rallies. There simply isn't the time.
Buddy?
Maureen, this is Buddy Darden, and I really appreciate your insight into all of this legislation that affects our
education. Boy, he is still a politician, isn't he? That buddy.
But I do want to respectfully.
But he's right.
I do want to respectfully disagree with you about to whom this person should appoint who's in charge of trying to do something about some of these underperforming schools. The office of the governor in the state of Georgia is the most powerful office of all the offices almost combined. And with all due respect to the superintendent of schools or the of education, has very little power and very little prestige in that, because the money and the power go in and the prestige go into the governor's office. And if that governor's office is responsible for this person doing something about the underperforming schools, I think the results would be a whole lot easier to obtain, because the people in these schools are going to respect that turnaround officer.
Maureen, let me give
because
you a quick...
he has the imprimatur of the power of the governor.
Maureen, let me give you a quick chance to respond to that, and then I want to ask you about a couple other aspects of the measure.
Well, you know, respect is lovely, but money is very important in this. And my concern is that we have this CTO. I think that the budget approved today allots $2.2 million for House Bill 338 for the CTO structure. I simply don't know if that's enough to do what the mission sets out to do. And I think a CTO who comes into a school with great ideas, if you read the legislation now, it holds the local schools responsible for financing these great ideas. I simply think schools in poor communities don't need an expert coming in and telling them all the special programs their kids need. I think they know a lot what their kids need. They simply can't afford them. And we're not on the federal issue right now, but the cuts to education possibly coming from the Trump administration, these schools are going to be even more hard-pressed.
Well, and I want to, before we move on to another measure that's down there right now, you made an important point. Although the state is going to ultimately determine which schools are targeted for this, it is, in fact, the legislation requires that the school districts that are targeted will have to work to come up with an implementation plan, and then, unless they have great financial need, they're going to be the ones that have to pay for this plan. And again, working outside of DOE, questions are raised about whether or not the money that they'll have to raise is really going to go to help students in the way that the local school district would want to do it, right?
Well, Bill, this is where I take issue with you and Maureen, is that the governor, if he or she is behind something, they can always find the money. There are pots of money around the state that only the governor can access, and only the governor knows where the money is hidden and how it can be expended. So the governor, as you know, is also the head of the budget. He makes the revenue estimates. The governor has almost complete control. Once the legislature goes home, which will be at the latest
next week,
Thursday, yeah.
Then the governor has things totally under his control. So that's where the power is and the money.
And that's basically the governor's argument. And remember, as Maureen mentioned, not only does this governor have a very tortured relationship with Richard Woods, but John Barge before him primaried this governor.
Yeah.
So there is little inclination from the deal staff to vest that power.
And I do think it's part of the good part of what happens is if the local has to work with the chief turnaround officer to figure out how it's going to happen, then you have the two sides working together. And I want to push back a little bit about resources. While resources are important, I'll give you an example. I've used it here before. I have a friend whose child went to a public school in Metro Atlanta, not part of the APS, but outside. And he transferred in, and his teacher didn't know he was in that class after weeks. Okay, so if you have a teacher who doesn't even know whose kids are in their classroom, wasn't aware he was in there, didn't bother to take roll. So that's not a money problem. That's a caring problem. So I'm just saying we have a lot of things to figure out. We got to figure out how much we can do without money, how much money we do need. But I think it's really important that this governor is looking at education, understands how important it is, and wants to make it a priority.
Maureen, please correct me if I'm wrong. Excuse me. But I think it's you, among other people out there, who have written that one of the problems with this measure and a lot of the other so-called reform bills that we see come along to help underperforming schools is they don't get at the real heart of things. They don't get at the needs that a community in a low-income neighborhood, what those kids have. And none of these things address the environment, the overall problems that the community faces. Am I right that you've written about that?
Yes, and I think, you know, a good parallel story, a cautionary tale, is that we recently had the findings of, did the Obama school improvement grants that always get abbreviated to SIG, S-I-G, did they help? Because they were part of Race to the Top. They put billions into school systems. And the bottom line, those schools didn't do any better than the schools that didn't get the SIG grants. And the reason is they weren't organic. So they were, there was money dropped in from the feds. There was no sort of necessarily local buy-in. And on top of that, when the money ran out, the programs ran out. And it was sort of like they came in with one specific area they were going to work on, when in fact what you're talking about, we have these kids coming in from low-income areas with language deficit. We have them not exposed to numbers. We have so much stuff that we need to do between 0 and 5. And I wish that the legislature and the governor, if they were going to put a lot of money into anything, would look at the fact that the research tells us 0 to 5, 0 to 3, we have to get in there and get those kids going.
Greg, before we move on to another bill, you get the last word on this.
Well, yeah, I mean, one thing that's also important to remember is the governor did not campaign on the Failing Schools Initiative, any of this. This was not even barely mentioned during his 2014 re-election campaign. It was all about a more fundamental overhaul of the school funding formula that might have gone to early childhood, that might have gone more to these struggling schools. But that was pretty much abandoned from the day one of his second term inauguration.
All right. It's an interesting discussion, but according to your bill tracker, Greg and Maureen, the chances of this bill making it all the way to the governor's desk are not particularly good. Are they good? Is this bill going to go to the governor for a signature, or have I misread the odds on this thing passing?
You know, I see what our bill tracker is saying, but I think it has a better chance than what we're predicting.
Oh, okay.
I agree.
You know, I would never, by the way, ever predict anything the legislature does, particularly these last few days. But it seemed to me the bill is being met cordially, and they have, in fact, retreated on some issues. In fact, you know, I think that, you know, this bill will probably even do less now than it could have done with the changes they've made. But I don't know, Greg, what do you think? Do you think it's...
I think it's a shoo-in. You can hold me to account next week or two.
All right.
Weeks.
I love that.
I think
it's in.
Yeah, I agree.
By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and some of you already are. Let's move on. We just got a couple more minutes to talk education. Maureen, the other thing the legislature passed on Monday was the bill that will expand the pool of money available for scholarships to private schools, correct?
Yes, we call that the voucher bill.
Yeah,
I call it the private school giveaway.
Wait, okay, go ahead, Maureen.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a disastrous bill. I mean, that is, first of all, you know, that program is shrouded in such secrecy. We have no idea where that's money going. You know, there was early indications that money was being, people were giving their, you know, diverting their tax money to private school scholarships, then given to their own children or their own or grandchildren. You know, I think people can choose private schools. My parents chose private schools. I'm a product of 12 years of Catholic school, but they paid for it. I simply think that with our public schools so underfunded, with the high number of poor kids we have in Georgia, we cannot divert tax money to private school scholarships.
And this new measure increases it exponentially, doesn't
right,
it?
Right, $7 million a year, right.
That's a lot of money.
Right, because it's $58 million right now. I mean, that is $58 million in money that should have come to the general fund that went to private school scholarships.
Well, the House would have you raise it to $100 million, and I think it is absolutely scandalous that even the legislature would even consider this, much less vote on it. But I will say that it is a very questionable legality, and right now it is pending before the Supreme Court of Georgia, because this represents, at least in my limited legal opinion, an outright gratuity or giveaway. And what you're doing is you're allowing a person to give a so-called scholarship. And by the way, for that scholarship, it will go to my grandchild or my child, and I can take that as a tax credit, not a tax deduction, a tax credit. So we're just robbing the taxpayers in favor of people who want to pay for their kids to go to private schools. And I sent my child to a private school, to Westminster, for 4 years. I paid for it. I didn't get any tax benefit from it.
But I mean, from the school standpoint, I understand why they would want it. This allows for them to be able to secure funds that wouldn't be accessed other ways, and clearly for them to be able to increase their scholarship pool and to allow either academic scholarships or scholarships for diversity or athletics, I think is very important from their perspective. I think, you know, Georgia's in a place right now, luckily, where we have a budget where we actually can think about things like this. I can remember not too far in the past when we're worried about making our budget work from a state standpoint. So I do think that, you know, because we're where we are economically, we begin to think about other ways to help out our economy. And it'll be interesting to see where it goes. My guess is, you know.
This is going to pass, isn't it, Maureen?
Yes, I think it's going to pass.
So we'll watch for that one as well. Before we let you get back to work, Maureen, I appreciate the time you've taken. Is there any other measure out there that you're watching this session that you think has a big will have an impact, significant or moderately important in terms of education this year?
You know, I think two bills that have gotten a lot of attention but actually have minimal impact in my mind are the recess bill. You know, that's a feel-good bill. Parents want their kids to have recess. Most kids do have recess. This sort of puts it out there that they should have recess.
Do they really have? I know you have children. Maureen, like you, Jackie, has raised a big family of kids.
Yeah, I've raised Maureen with you. I think everyone should have recess. Unfortunately, I know of schools that don't have recess, so even though it makes me feel good to have this bill, I think it's important for all kids to have recess or physical activity every single day. You wouldn't think it would require a bill to actually have that happen, but evidently it does, because there are schools that I know of that don't have recess, and I cannot imagine when my son was young trying to make him sit down all day if he hadn't run around for a while. So I think it's good to have the kids have a chance to get outside or to do something that's physical every day.
But, Jackie, don't you think that the school people ought to determine this as a good conservative? You don't think that government ought to be involved in prescribing recess,
do you? I love it when you argue my side, buddy. That makes me so happy.
But, Maureen, recess, help me with this. My recollection is that recess went the way of any number of other, what we used to think of as elective classes, music and art and all, back when schools were saying we do not have enough hours in the day to teach core curriculum. We're being pushed harder and harder on this. And so all things like recess disappeared. Is that sort of the history of this, or am I wrong?
Well, you know, one of the things that schools do, and it's political in a way, is when they're asked to do other things, they sort of hold hostage to the things parents love, art, music, recess, and they say a lot of those things are going to be threatened by the new emphasis on, you know, more math and more reading. And in fact, you know, some of those programs have gone away, but I think for the most part, at least in the elementary schools, I would say most Georgia schools have recess. I do agree with Jackie that if they don't have it, they should have it. I think what happens is that recess gets canceled for other things they need to do. And I know, for example, that even local schools here that have recess, when they were in the testing and they come back with their pretest and their kids aren't doing well, then they begin this whole entire, you know, sort of, death march where they're testing every day to get ready for the state milestones test. So I think that's what happens to recess. It gets sacrificed. So, you know, again, I think, though, I agree with Buddy that I'm not sure the legislature needs to do this. This is a role for parents. I mean, parents at the local level, they have influence, and they need to use it. They certainly use it in most of the suburban Atlanta systems where they turn out in force for issues. So I think, again, that I hate that the state feels the need to get into this, but I do think parents should be the ones pushing the schools.
All right. Maureen Downey, we really appreciate your coming on and talking to us about some of these issues that are unfolding down at the state capitol. We always love having you on to talk education, Maureen, so thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, and have a good day to the rest of you.
Okay, bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break, and oh my gosh, we have a lot to talk about, don't we? We've got the health care bill, where that thing stands right now. We've got the latest on the Gorsuch hearings. We're going to take a quick one and come back with more of Political Rewind after this.
It may not be your favorite time of the year, but it'll be here before you know it. That's right, tax time. Here's one way to lighten the load. Get a tax deduction by donating your vehicle to GPB. You'll support the programs you love and get a tax break. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR to schedule your free pickup or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Buddy Darden, Jackie Cushman, Greg Bluestein are here with me. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. By the way, we just got a tweet from Riley Scott, who says, goes to a runoff now. No, and I think what he's talking about is we've, over the last couple weeks, tried a bunch of different theme songs. He's probably right. We're going to have to figure out what to do next about that. Although Khalid, who tweets us frequently, really likes the theme song we have right now. So we're going to figure this out in the next little while. Greg Bluestein, tomorrow night, we expect that the House is going to be in a position of voting on their health care plan. Paul Ryan has been pushing this thing like crazy, yeah?
Yeah, we think there'll be a vote tomorrow night.
Right.
I can imagine them bringing it to a vote if they don't have the votes. And apparently the leaders of the House Freedom Caucus, you know, the conservative opponents to this, say they still don't have the votes. They need about 22 Republicans. They can't afford to lose 22 Republicans, and the House Freedom Caucus says it has about 30 no votes alone. So it's going to be real down to the wire.
So Donald Trump has gotten engaged in this in a way that at first some people suggested he might not. He has made it clear that this isn't what he wants, that he wants to work on tax reform, but he felt that Paul Ryan convinced him he had to take this on first. So yesterday, let's listen to just a little sound here. The president went to the Hill. Talked to members of the GOP conference, and Paul Ryan thought he was phenomenal in talking to them about health care.
I got to just say, editorial, the president just came here and knocked the ball out of the park. He knocked the cover off the ball and explained to our members how it's important to unify, how it's important to work together, how we are advancing our principles and we are doing what we told the American people we would do. This is our chance, and this is our moment. It's a big moment, and I think our members are beginning to appreciate just what kind of a rendezvous with destiny we have right here.
Later last night, President Trump was at an RNCC fundraising dinner. He, too, talked about the health care bill as an important part of his legislative agenda. Let's listen to what he said.
That legislative effort begins with Thursday's crucial vote. And it really is a crucial vote for the Republican Party and for the people of our country to finally repeal and replace the disaster known as Obamacare. It's what it is, a disaster.
Jackie, this is a tough bill, no matter, you know, to be the speaker, you're the daughter of a former speaker of the House. He's got the conservatives who want him to take away more entitlements from the measure. He's got moderates saying, you better help with the safety net. What the heck do we see unfolding here?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, you're right. This is a very tough bill. It's very complex. Even people that cover it all the time, it's very hard to understand. For people that read about it in the newspaper, it's almost unimaginable. It makes requires really hard decisions from people. And the other thing that happens, if you look at it from the House side, I mean, Speaker Ryan, he's Speaker, but all of those House members, as soon as they're sworn in, they start running again. I mean, they're already worried about running in 2 years. So everyone's thinking about what happens when I go home. And you've had very vocal exchanges when they come home to on the congressional side. So, you know, this is a big test for Paul Ryan. It's a big test for President Trump. I think, you know, they're going to do everything they can. The good thing about Trump is, you know, he has clearly negotiated a lot. He understands negotiation. He understands in negotiations that everybody must win something. Otherwise, you don't actually get to a deal. I think Paul Ryan is very determined to make this this happen. And I think until they actually vote, we're not going to know.
Two or three things I think are significant to show you how the bill's in trouble. Second, first of all, they're sweetening the pot. They put about $85 billion of sweeteners in there already just to bring around some of the recalcitrant members. And this is the only way they're going to do it is one by one, is pick them off. I think in the end they will probably get the votes, barely. But I think they'll somehow pull it off and get just the minimum they need. But they do this, though, at the risk of saying to some of the members who've been there all along, one, if you went along early, then you don't get anything. That's a problem. And the second thing I think is even worse is that trying to tell the members that, hey, don't worry about it, it's not perfect, but we're going to fix it in the Senate.
Well, and that strikes me as being, that's exactly what they're doing. The Speaker, with Donald Trump's approval or his support, has said, yeah, We understand your concerns and your criticism. For instance, see, older Americans do not get tax credits that many people like AARP are really worried about. It really hurts them. So the speaker says, well, we've already fixed that. The Senate will take that up. Boy, that's a dangerous spot for a House member to be in, Greg.
It really is, especially when you look over across the hall and the Senate. There are at least six Republican senators who are already saying that they're not a fan of this legislation as written now. And you've also got conservatives who have plenty of cover from other conservative groups. Not only you know, the AARPs of the world that aren't necessarily conservative, but also Club for Growth and other conservative super PACs who are saying, don't worry, if you oppose this, we will have your back.
Yeah, the president yesterday, the White House claims it wasn't a threat. But I think there are members who probably heard it as a threat, basically saying, if you don't support us, we're coming after you.
I'll come to your backyard.
But as you point out, the conservative organizations like Club for Growth are saying, don't worry about it. We're gonna be there for you when you're up
absolutely.
For re-election.
But I mean, this is part of how politics works. I mean, you know, if you're the president and you're new president and you're the Speaker of the House and this is important to you and you go to your members and you tell them that, then, you know, that's political reality. I mean, Buddy's shaking his head, yes. I mean, this is how it works when you run in politics. If you're not behind your team and your team needs you, then you're in trouble. Now, what will happen, I think Buddy's right, I think in the end it'll pass. I think it'll be very close. But they're going to have to figure out, they're going to look and see who can they, you know, how can you make people vote for it? How can you appeal to them? But also, which one in the end do you want to be able to excuse because their districts may be tight enough that they actually can't vote for it? So this is a very complicated subject. In the end, I think it will be passed, but it's going to be, you know, until we actually get the votes, we're not going to know.
Buddy, what's it like? You've been there. What's it like when there's a big measure that the White House wants and you're on the hot seat because they want you to support their measure?
It's tough, and what you want them to do is succeed, but that you want to be able to do it without you. And the optimal situation is to be able to vote no, and it passed. One day I was in the cloakroom talking to the vice president on the phone, and he was explaining to me why we need to do so-and-so. And they said, excuse me, the president's on the other line to talk to you. And not because I was that important. I don't mean that. But that just shows you how close these things can be. And the president and the vice president actually get on the phone, mm-hmm. and they will promise you anything and everything just to get you to vote.
All right. Having said that, this is a president whose disapproval number is higher than any other president at this point in his early tenure. This is a president who has been caught in one controversy, some would say scandal. Let's just say he's been a controversial person. The question becomes whether, and this is a president who can't necessarily deliver the Senate. So, Greg, if you're a House member, why do you want to go out on the limb over this? And does the president right now have the power and the standing to get your vote?
Well, that's the thing. That, as Buddy was talking about, the concessions, I think he's exactly right. This is going to force senators to try to wring out as many concessions as they want, because the president still has that power to say, like he said to a New York congresswoman, well, we can throw in some extra money to help defray the costs here, or we can reconsider our, you know, we can double down on our Cuban stance to a Miami congressman. He did both of those yesterday.
Yeah, he suggested that in exchange for voting, and again, I don't mean this is inappropriate. As we've all said,
this happens, right?
But I was a little surprised that the president was willing to throw into the mix the possibility that he would overturn Obama's opening to Cuba in exchange for winning a vote. That's going a long way.
Hey, this is a guy, I don't know if you've read The Art of the Deal. If you haven't, I would suggest you pick it up and read it. If you have, I suggest you reread it. This is a guy who believes strongly in negotiation. This is a guy who strongly believes in throwing out whatever he thinks might work and then figuring out what does work. He is used to getting yes for an answer at some point, and I think he'll work very hard to get there.
And this
they
is
will
also
promise you anything. They will promise you anything. Appointments. Trips, audiences, yeah. Fundraisers.
Pictures, White House
everything
party.
Is on the table, right? You
State
got it,
dinners.
Jackie.
Yeah, whatever.
And this is also a guy who can still, you know, he'll get 10,000 people on a Tuesday night in mm-hmm. your backyard, in your district, whether or not you are moderate or a conservative Republican.
People.
And so that's got to factor into these guys' decisions, too.
So, Jackie, let me go back to you again, because you lived this when your father was Speaker. There are those who suggest that in his zeal and because of his longstanding commitment to repeal and replace, that Paul Ryan has not, he's charged this without the kind of thoughtful process that might have, in a slower way, made this not quite as difficult a challenge. Is this going to be a test of Paul Ryan's leadership? And more than just his, because it is that, if it fails,
right.
or if they have to pull it,
the house, right.
he's in trouble. But is it also say something about whether Ryan, who's a good retail politician, is a smart, it has the smarts on how to get bills through Congress?
Well, I think it's less about getting bills through Congress than it is about the strategy of when to put bills up, which I think is kind of what you're saying.
It is,
right.
yeah.
And I
Thank
think
you for saying it
no,
better.
No, but I think there is something to that, because it's not only about, you know, Paul Ryan has been Speaker. He was Speaker, obviously, before Trump was elected. But it's different when you're working as Speaker against a Democratic president, and then when the president is in your own party. There are different dynamics and different things happen. So I do think, I mean, it might have been strategically smarter to step back and pass some things earlier that were easier and to get some momentum before you tackle something like this. But, you know, at this point, here we are. You know, it is what it is.
Well, we never heard the word replace until, of course, Trump got elected. It was always repeal, and that's simple because everybody's for repeal. We're going to repeal it. We're going to repeal it. And that was the opposition message. All of a sudden, they own health care now, and what are we going to do? And it's a hard problem. I mean, if you look at the history of the American, the ACA, also known as Obamacare, that was originally a Republican idea. What we Democrats wanted to do mm-hmm. was have a single payer. To go from cradle to grave. And, in fact, Mitt Romney, as you know, adopted something similar
in
Massachusetts.
Yes.
So this is actually a Heritage Foundation-type idea, which was refined a little bit. And so people who have Obamacare and think it's the worst thing in the world don't realize that, hey, that's their health care now.
Yeah, well, which takes us back, Greg. I'm going to kind of throw two things at you at once. It takes us back to a question that I think some of us have been asking for a while. Why are they doing this at all? I mean, I get it. They made this campaign promise, and they've been making it for years, but nobody went into this because they really thought they had a smarter idea for healthcare. I mean, it really is hard to watch this process unfold and think that great minds were working on how to create a better healthcare system.
Well, we've now seen this for two presidential cycles because it was the centerpiece for the 2012 campaign as well.
Exactly.
But when you're Donald Trump and you have gone to pretty much every rally saying, "Oh, I'm going to repeal the terrible Obamacare," you've got to come through. And as Buddy said, you only have so much political capital those first 100 days, and it
raises the question of why not fix, which is what Democrats have suggested. Why not fix what everyone acknowledges are significant problems in ACA and Obamacare?
Because haven't Republicans tarnished the name, at least among their own electorate, of Obamacare so much that they can't?
I think reality is interesting. I can't remember who said it earlier, but you know, here they are, they're doing what they promised to do. That is Trump. And this is what people have been saying, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe he's doing A, B, or C." It's what he campaigned on.
Right.
So we shouldn't be surprised. I do think on the opposite side of my comment earlier, if they do get this passed and it actually goes through and gets all the way and gets signed, I think in terms of, you will look back and say, "Oh my gosh, that was so brilliant," because if they can do that, they can do anything. You know?
Well, okay, that was the other part of the question I wanted to ask. Jackie's right in terms of strategic thinking. I mean, if they can make this happen, right, Paul Ryan looks like a hero. He doesn't even care if the Senate passes it or not. He just wants to make sure his own members do. But then we live with the consequences. And if you look at states like Georgia, even the governor of Georgia has said repeatedly, "We're going to be hurt by this because we didn't expand Medicaid. We're going to pay a penalty for that." It is likely that a lot of Georgians are going to lose health care under this plan. And then 2018 comes along and we'll see how great this strategy was when they're all up for re-election, right?
I mean, the bill's still changing, but boy, could this bill put Georgia in a bind. And Governor Deal and other Republican leaders are making no bones about it. To the governor's view, he he made the fiscal conservative stand by not expanding Medicaid. That's how he views it. That's what he said. It was too expensive in the long run. So he thought he was doing what was right. And now he says, I could be punished. Georgia could be punished for holding the line against more federal spending. And they're very concerned in the governor's office and at the state legislature. Their initial version of the plan would basically give more money to states that had more generous Medicaid funding. So basically help the states that had expanded Medicaid and hurt states like Georgia that hadn't. Now it looks like the latest version wouldn't even let Georgia expand Medicaid even if it wanted
ahead
to.
Ahead of the deadline, right?
Yeah, so now, you know, they were already in a really tough dilemma. Now it's almost a possible.
And you've got a number of governors in states that did expand Medicaid, Republican governors, saying, wait a minute, you know, we bit the bullet. We expanded Medicaid. We don't want you to tamper. So it's a tough spot, right? Buddy, I'm on your side, and I think Jackie said the same thing. This is such a crucial bill for Speaker Ryan and now for Donald Trump. I would find it hard to imagine. Yes, legislative minds go their own direction. I cannot imagine they're going to let this thing fail.
But it's going to be hard to vote against your own state. And that's the situation that the Georgians find themselves in. Mm-hmm. The latest I heard was only Jody Heiss was mm-hmm. going to be against it. And,
yes.
And I think the other Georgians have come into. But yes. Now,
Loudermilk after Trump personally met with him.
Right. But if it turns out that it doesn't get fixed in the Senate or it doesn't get fixed in the House, then you've got opponents running against these congressmen in a year and a half saying, you voted against your own state's best interest for totally political reasons.
All right, well, we're going to watch this unfold. We do think the Speaker wants a vote tomorrow night. I think I'm right, Jackie, that one of the reasons they're pushing so hard for Thursday night is they've got some work days in their districts coming up, don't they, pretty quickly after this? And they do not want to send members home to confront angry town halls.
They want to go ahead and get this done. I mean, you got them in motion. Everything's in turmoil, but you want to get it done. The other interesting thing is that this original act, the ACA Act, was signed by President Obama on March 23rd,
yes,
2010.
That's right.
So it would be the anniversary.
All right. Look, we're getting. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we got to get another break in at 2:47. We'll be back. We're going to talk a little bit about Judge Gorsuch and his confirmation hearings. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer talks about Robert Mercer, the hedge fund tycoon who has become a major force behind the Trump presidency. The libertarian Mercer family spent millions funding Breitbart News and other conservative causes and played a critical role in bringing Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway into the leadership of the Trump campaign. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein, Jackie Cushman, and Buddy Darden at the table for today's conversation. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Let me just cherry pick a couple. Silma Johns, who tweets at Sly Round a World, says, thank you for pointing out that ACA was originally a Republican idea. It's not. We've pointed it out on a number of occasions, but I'm glad you heard that. I want to do a quick go-round, really quick if we can. Start with you, Buddy. Donald Trump, we have not been on the air since FBI Director James Comey testified, number one, that they are in fact investigating Russian ties to the Trump campaign, and number two, that there is no evidence. This was the most anticlimactic statement ever, I think. There is no evidence that Trump was wiretapped, although this revelation today suggests what I talked about last week, which was if he's picked up on incidental contact, he's going to use that as his opportunity to get around this. How much do both of those things hurt the president?
The word of the president of the United States is tantamount to the prestige and power of our country. And Donald Trump has run the risk of making a statement which is false and based on pure supposition and which has been proven false. And this rather lame attempt that came out today saying that what it might have been different, I think, will fall flat on its face.
Jackie?
You know, I want to pause for a minute. I hear what Buddy's saying, but, you know, today's revelation that there may have been some, quote, incidental,
listening.
Yeah. I mean, that is concerning. I mean, I don't care if you targeted me or you accidentally targeted somebody next to me, but you caught what I was saying. that is still surveillance from my perspective on me. Okay,
yeah.
You heard what I said. You were listening to my conversations. I think there's a lot we don't know, and I think we're going to learn more obviously as things unfold. And I think we just need to be patient and watch.
You know, Jackie, I think you just said an important thing. There's been some criticism of Republicans who, in response to hearing the Comey testimony the other day, have said, "Well, let's just see how this develops." And there have been an awful lot of people who have been saying, "What do you mean, Wade? The FBI director just told you there's nothing to this." Well, today's report, but we'll see how it develops, says maybe it's not a bad idea to wait and see how all of this plays out. Greg?
Yeah, my take on this is I think Americans from both parties don't just want to be able to trust their president, they need to. And when you make these evidence-based accusations with no evidence, I should say, and there's a string of them, this is just the latest, it does start to erode your credibility, and there will come a time, sometime in the next 3 or 4 years, where we're going to need to. There will be something, some crisis, something that happens overseas or here domestically that we're going to need to trust our president, and there will be a credibility gap there.
Okay, well, we're going to follow, all of us will, obviously, this story that Devin Nunes brought to our attention, all of our attentions at a news conference today. We'll see how it develops. I want to move on to the Gorsuch hearings. I bet you there are an awful lot of people in this audience. Well, the older people like me who are part of who are listening to this show, and Buddy Darden is up there with me, for whom Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was a movie that really, really helped inspire our love of politics. And I just want to play for you a brief moment of Jimmy Stewart in that picture.
And that Lincoln Memorial, gee whiz, Mr. Lincoln, there he is. Doggone it, did you ever have so much to say about something you just couldn't say it? Gosh, I don't know where I'd be in this bill of mine if it wasn't for your help.
Jimmy Stewart, the young senator, goes to Washington, inspired, overwhelmed, naive about it all. And that reminded those of us who are work on this show of something we've heard much more recently, like, oh, say yesterday in the Neil Gorsuch confirmation hearing.
Goodness knows, Senator. And have I ruled against the government? My goodness. Last time I saw him, I want to say it was 2008. I mean, golly, I've written over, well, gosh, written or joined over 6 million words. Goodness knows. Goodness knows. Well, maybe that's the, gosh, is that the, it's the Gettysburg Address.
That's, look, I don't think anybody, whether you're on his side philosophically or not, no one would argue that this is a man who has a serious intellect in terms of the law. But this attempt of his, for those of us who watched this unfold yesterday, to portray himself as this sort of Jimmy Stewart.
Oh, shucks.
Son of a gun.
you're so cynical.
Yes.
Bill, you are. Okay, just yesterday, my daughter Maggie, we were standing in the kitchen, and she was like, oh, Mom, my friends, you know, whenever I say things, I'm like, gosh, and golly. I mean, she actually said, so some people actually say that, just so you know.
Do you think he talks that way? Or
I don't know. I don't know the gentleman, but, you know, I try not to be cynical all the time.
Gee whiz, Jackie.
Well, let me say this.
It sounds so much better than other things I've been called.
let me surprise everyone here with this statement. Is I do think that he ought to be confirmed. And I think that
none of what I suggested was that he shouldn't be confirmed.
For the position. My arguments with him and with his background and so forth really don't rise to the level of his not being qualified. And so I don't think there's any doubt that the man is qualified, and he, after all, has been nominated by the president. And even though he was put off on the president by the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, I think they're still better off naming the justice than the president himself. So I have no problem with that. People elected Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has a right to make that choice. That being said, however, I do think that it is tragic and almost criminal the way that Judge Garland was treated. And I understand the frustration of some of my fellow Democrats. However, two wrongs don't make a right. And so I think it's time to move forward and put this behind us because, frankly speaking, he could have done a whole lot worse.
Well, let me just say know what that little montage was, an effort to kind of poke fun at the way he talked, none of which has to do with whether he would be a great Supreme Court justice or not. Who knows? We'll see. But I can't imagine much of that language working its way into the opinions he writes.
We start to see Yiddish words in those.
So. Golly.
Golly gee.
Golly. A woman's right to choose, gee whiz. We've got a tweet from Ben Andrews, who tweets at Ben Andrews 21, who asks a great question. Does Trump want to say told you so about incidental surveillance if it means he communicated with people the FBI is suspicious of? Interesting questions, Greg.
Yeah, and I think we'll start to find the answers to those as we get a little more details from the House Intelligence Committee.
Dave says, does your panel agree or disagree with Senator Schumer that that Gorsuch should be blocked since the Trump White House is under investigation? Personally, I don't see that connection. Mm-hmm. No? Yeah.
I don't either. I think that's a non-starter, and I understand what Schumer's trying to do is drag it out and drag it out. However, it's time to put this behind us because we've got a lot of other issues to worry about.
All right, we're almost out of time, but since this is a political show, I thought we should end today and give you a quick chance to respond to facts we didn't know until the president brought them to our attention. Here he is last night.
Our first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln. Most people don't even know he was a Republican, right? Does anyone know? A lot of people don't know that. We have to build that up a little bit more. Let's take an ad. Let's use one of those packs.
Did you know that?
I did know that.
Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Don't they have a Lincoln Day every year?
Absolutely. Raising money. Yeah, you go.
Well, you know, okay, Absolutely. So we're having fun. We're poking fun. It's kind of like, gee, whoever thought healthcare could be so complicated.
He probably didn't know until last night.
Because he's not. Look, nobody has ever argued that this guy is a Republican and been a Republican forever, so he is still learning. All right, that's it. We're out of time for today's show. My thanks to Greg Bluestein, to Jackie Cushman, to Buddy Darden for being here, and earlier Maureen Downey for her contributions to the show. We're going to be back Friday at 3 o'clock, and of course we've got a lot to watch between now and then, because remember, we think the House is going to vote tomorrow night on their health care package. We'll wait to see if they pull it before then, if they go ahead with the vote. If they can't, they're not going to vote if they can't pass it, I think it's probably safe to say. But then the question is, if they don't vote on it, what happens next with that legislation? We're going to watch to see how the Devin Nunes comments today unfold and whether that gives us some more information about whether President Trump has any basis for his claim that he was wiretapped in some way. The legislature, Greg, before we get out of here, are they in session again this week or do they get back next week?
Yeah, another day this week, two more days next week.
Okay, so we're going to watch to see what they do. We'll have all that and more for you on the Friday edition of the show. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. And in a little while, Greg Bluestein is going to post on the AJC Political Insider blog the audio from today's show so you can share it with all of your friends. That's it for us for today. We'll be back at 3 on Friday. My thanks to Tyler Morris, to Jenny Amond, to Lisa Clark. You're a great team. We'll be back here at 3 on Friday, all of us.